Gotta love that guy, David Palmer, singing for Steely Dan on that track. One of the few that was not one of the main guys from Steely Dan. Also, didn't he do, did he write the lyrics for Jazzman, I think, the old Carole King song? David Palmer, that's a guy you don't hear enough about. Can't Buy a Thrill, though, from Steely Dan, one of the greatest albums of all time. I think Rolling Stone said it was like 250 or something like that on the top 500. I would have ranked it higher. In fact, if I ever started my own band, I was thinking about Steely Dan's Can't Buy a Thrill. I thought it'd be fun to name it after Vanna White, though, and call it Steely Van Can't Buy a Vowel. But I don't know how many people would. I'll never start a band. I have great names and great album titles if I ever actually got around to starting a band. Too late for me, but not for our guest. We've been playing tracks. We'll do one more at the bottom of the hour from Big Dirt. That's the band from David Montgomery, who's a professor at University of Washington. The book is called Dirt. It's The Erosion of Civilizations. The phones are full. Even before we gave the phone numbers, they were practically full. We'll get to your questions and comments next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. I don't even know where to start. So many questions, and I hope you're ready for these. You never know, David, where this will end up, so just buckle in, because we'll go to all of the questions and comments about dirt. Let's start with Sam, east of the Rockies, upstate New York on Coast to Coast AM. Sam, did I hit the button right? Or we'll put him on hold for a second. Maybe he walked away from the radio for the moment. We'll go to Teresa in Boulder, Colorado, for David Montgomery. Teresa, your soil questions, please.
Well, I want to tell David that his idea of sustainable soil is totally wrong.
Okay.
Nobody can afford it. No one can afford it. I had a community garden here in Boulder. It was 16 by 36. I paid a few dollars, like 65. It went up every year. I would spend more planting with organic materials than I, well, a better way to say it is I sowed better than I reaped.
Okay. To be,
out of it. It was like, you know, what are these people talking about? What are they talking about?
David?
You know, be green.
Let's hear what he has to say. Go ahead, David.
Well, it's hard for me to comment on your experience directly, but there's an awful lot of community gardens in Seattle that grow a lot of food quite productively, and some of the most cost-effective and profitable farms are small-scale organic operations. I don't have any way of knowing sort of how much you were charged or what the situation is in Boulder in terms of being charged for community gardens, but in the long run, an awful lot of public space in cities could be converted to urban food gardens, and it should not involve a major cost. A lot of what actually goes into creating a very productive small-scale organic garden is labor.
Aren't we, if we're really talking about in an urban setting, don't you need something as large as like a golf course in the middle of the city to provide enough space?
Well, it depends how much if you're going to have a very large farm to feed a lot of the people in the city, then yeah, you need a fair amount of space, unless you can figure out a way to do it, sort of stack it vertically indoors, which is, there's ways to do, but that may actually get to her point that could be quite expensive.
Okay. West of the Rockies, Sterling in Eagle Mountain, Utah. Sterling?
Hi, Ian, Dave. I enjoyed listening to the show this evening.
Good. Hey. You're talking with David. Go ahead.
Okay. I usually listen to Coast via the archives, but I had to stay up late tonight because I have recently become aware and have viewed a technology that actually would do away with the need for soil while producing organic produce plus quality super economically.
That would be what?
Well, the company's called Synergy Farms, and they're now ready to build out their first production prototype facility, which is an 80,000 square foot warehouse that I visited. That from 1 acre, that's the 80,000 square foot, would produce as much as a 230 acre farm on regular land. It's It's an amazing confluence of some of the very best technologies while holding the tried and true principles of growing.
Is it basically just a big giant chia pet?
Well, they do. They have fish that provide the nutrients that goes into a mist. So it's an aeroponic system, a periodic misting of the roots to give the plants the nutrients they need. You don't even use soil. And then you have those racks 20 feet high in the warehouse, and then they have a high-definition lighting, fluorescent lighting that they've developed that can actually be dimmed from zero to full so you can imitate the light cycles. And also you can do the climate control, so you can have the temperature you need, super great insulation, some stuff they've also developed. The Synergy Solution Company, which is the parent company for this initiative, they've been in business for 5 years. I've been involved with them to a certain extent, promoting the product at a Mono radio show that I did about 3 years ago.
Well, you're a very good promoter. Let's go ahead and hear from David on that. Aeroponic, the future of our sustainability will be we'll all have to grow a clear thumb, so to speak.
Well, it sounds like an interesting idea. I'd love to learn more about the technology and what they've actually set up there. You know, one question would be, what are they feeding the fish to drive the process? But the idea of trying to create sort of small-scale systems that link things like fish production and nutrient cycling into very small-scale intensive agriculture, those are the kind of technologies that we really should be looking at. And so, I mean, it sounds like a fairly interesting idea.
Here's what might be my concern. If you've got fish that are involved in the creation of the water to the mist to the plant roots, wouldn't we all have to be worried about salmonella? Never mind. That's kind of a bad joke. Let me get to Sean, who's in Oakland, California, on Coast to Coast. Sean?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, gentlemen. I had that same I was trying to get at that same sort of question, and to sort of correct the last caller, the process he was referring to was the NFT system, in fact, invented by George Carver Washington. Yeah, a little nervous there. Interestingly, which was the nutrient, the nutrient NFT. It's a nutrient film technique in which, essentially the roots are moistened. And I was kind of going to ask David that same question. Are we seeing more of these aquaculture, agricultural design systems? Because that's something I've always been quite interested in, is the warehousing of these spaces and also the trellising in which we can, you know, grow on racks and grow in height. We don't need to always grow, you know, on stable land, and which would inevitably lead us to space-based agricultural systems in which we can actually get the ice from the atmosphere, melt it right there, and we provide our own water in our systems in space, which would then, you know, lead to anti-gravity systems and, you know, of the like. But are we seeing these kind of ideas, these kind of thoughts? Is this sort of
go ahead, Sean. Hang on. Take a breath. Let me see if we get David to answer. David?
Well, it sounds like from the last call, there's a company trying to actively pursue this. I've seen systems that are kind of analogous to this in terms of sort of fish production and farming sort of co-located with nutrient cycling in between them in areas in Asia that I've worked. It's not unlike the idea behind some rice paddy agriculture where the algae in the rice paddies not only fixes the nitrogen that fertilizes the rice, but it can actually feed fish that are living in the areas.
You said something there. I just have to stop. You said algae, and is this like a Niger thing where now everyone's going to say algae, and I'm going to be the only one saying algae for 5 more years? Do I have to make the jump now?
Oh, get with the program, yeah.
Yeah, when you academics decide to change something, we all thought it was Niger, and next thing you know, Niger, or you get stairs. So is it algae? Is that what I should have been calling it?
You know, normally I think I would call it algae, but
okay.
I may just I just, you know, slip into my ivory tower lingo every now and then, you know?
Okay. But is that actually the proper pronunciation?
You know, I have no clue.
Okay, fine. Just checking. You know, All right. Okay. I just want Joy is in Santa Cruz, California on Coast to Coast AM for David Montgomery, Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations. Joy?
Good morning. That was cute.
Hi, Joy.
Hi, David. Hello, Ian. First of all, David, I'm sorry about Zena.
Oh, thank you very much. I still miss her terribly.
What is this? What am I missing here?
Zena is David's dog.
Oh, I thought it was. I thought you were just bummed because they took Warrior Princess off the air.
Oh, I am bummed about that too.
I don't know. Science nerds had this thing about Zena. I know, so I didn't. No, so that was your dog. I'm sorry.
She was my best friend. I took her to work in total violation of university rules for 8 years.
Yay.
She was such a good girl that nobody ever complained.
Oh, that's sweet. I'm sorry you lost her.
Yeah.
So Go ahead, Joy.
I have two different things I wanted to talk to you about. One is about mycorrhizal fungi,
mm-hmm.
and the importance of that for gardeners, and because it's part of the balance of the soil. I used to work for Soil Conservation Service at the USDA.
Uh-huh.
And this is something that we tried to talk to people about, but it didn't really get through to people very well.
Yeah.
But this is so important for root growth for almost all plants.
Oh, and for maintaining the cycling of nutrients that then essentially that define soil fertility.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Soil is a living being, and it needs to be looked at that way rather than just as dirt.
Yeah. The point about the importance of sort of soil ecology and mycorrhizae in particular is really, really important. And in fact, my wife and I are starting now to work on a book that is essentially a follow-up to Dirt that is provisionally called From the Ground Up, that is an argument about how what we need to do to support agriculture in the long run is essentially restore soils and restore life in the soils, get away from the idea of using soils as sort of a chemical substrate that we can use as a factory to produce food, and instead get back to the idea of harvesting the natural ecological activity that's catalyzed through soil microbes and mycorrhizae and the life that's in soils, and that's the key to maintaining soil productivity over the long run. I mean, the one issue is keeping the soil on the field, so sort of the point of Dirt about erosion, but the point about soil fertility and the life in the soils is the huge next question, and Ann and I are starting, we're literally just sort of started to outline and we're looking for publishers for that next book.
Okay, Josie is in Virginia on Coast to Coast AM for David Montgomery. Go ahead, Josie.
Well, I have about three things here, and one of them that, David, you might be interested in is an Atlantic Monthly, and it was several years ago that I think I read this, and you'll have to look it up if you know how to work a computer. I don't. And it talked about the westward migration of these different sorts of peoples that came from maybe the Caucasus, and as the land kind of depleted, they kept moving west. They were the cereal, and he said it was cereal that was the major thing that made the armies strong. So they had to have that cereal, and as the soils went bad, they went kind of west, and they kept on going. That's the one thing that I wanted to mention to you. The other thing, there is some kind of new thing. There was somebody on Coast to Coast, and I cannot remember the man's name. I was half asleep. Terra Preta. Terra Preta.
Oh, yeah.
And that was mentioned as a phenomenal rich soil, and it was done thousands of years ago. They rediscovered it in the Amazon somehow, and that would be something to consider as a incredible soil builder. And then the last thing I wanted to say is that industrial hemp, not the other kind that you all were snickering about, but industrial hemp.
No, that's the kind I was talking about.
Okay.
So we're not talking Michael Phelps here.
No, that is, they shouldn't go after him. The what I wanted to say about that is that it draws up the pesticides out of the ground. It cleans the soil incredibly well. It takes out all of the it prevents the runoff from going into the streams and the lakes
right.
and polluting the rivers.
Right.
And there's a book called Great Book of Hemp by Rowan Robinson talks about this. And if the farmer next year wants to grow wheat, his yield will be incredibly better.
Yeah,
so
I'm
we
very
should get after our politicians about this. You know, this is ridiculous that we're spending $95 billion a year for this freaking marijuana thing to jail people and the like, but that's another subject.
Okay.
But still,
well, let's go ahead.
They put on Schedule 1, and you can't smoke it.
I totally understand that. I completely agree. And I it's weird to me that every time I take the position that's pro-hemp, inevitably, somehow somebody calls up and starts lecturing me on hemp. I'm already on board. I'm all for it. I think it's a great idea. So let's put the hemp thing aside. As you said, you have no opinion on that earlier. But what about the other thing? What about the Terra Preta thing? That's a very interesting subject.
Yeah, well, I'll check out the Atlantic Monthly article. I didn't know about that, and the idea and the caucuses, that makes sense. It's just very similar to the arguments I'm making in Dirt.
Right.
The Terra Preta thing is I've actually seen stuff like that in the Amazon doing field work there, and I wrote a little bit about it in the book. It is actually a really amazing
It's like a proto-dirt, isn't it? I mean, or like a kind of – almost like the – what did I read somewhere? They compared it to almost like cellular dirt at its basic level or something, where it's almost like what people are doing with genetic material here in the U.S. or something. Am I in the ballpark?
It's really good soil. And it's the weird thing about it is that it's found in the middle of the Amazon in the tropics, where the soil is mostly really poor. Because in a tropical rainforest, most of the soil nutrients are just recycled right back into the plants. They're not in the ground. The soils are it's hot. It's wet. The rocks are deeply weathered. All the nutrients are gone. They're just held in the plants. But this Terra Preta stuff is the soil that was built around native Amazonian villages over hundreds to thousands of years, when they literally would just take their garbage out and throw it in the back.
Right.
They'd go out behind their hut and take a leak. There was nutrient recycling on a local level that they were stationary for long enough. They lived in the same spot for long enough that that recycling really built up the nutrient content. The charcoal from their campfires got stirred back into the soil. So there's a lot of organic matter going back into the soil, and it's good enough soil today that there's Brazilian companies who dig it up and export it to the cities and sell it as potting soil.
Yeah.
And so it's actually a really good example of how people over the long run can improve their soils, and a big part of it seems to be the recycling of nitrogen and phosphorus from returning organic waste, but also the recycling of charcoal back into the soil really helps soil fertility.
Brian is in Florida on Coast to Coast AM for David Montgomery. Brian?
Hi.
Hi, Brian.
I just wanted to make a comment. Down here, we're working with nothing. We live on a sandbar. So to get things to grow, you have to be creative. I've got 3 years of horticulture, and I've run landscaping for about 20 years. I've had a business. And most of our customers had been the higher up, so they expect the best. And what we've tended to do was to any of our cuttings off of palm trees or pulling of the beds or anything, as long as it wasn't weeds that were in seed, we'd throw them out in the yard and mulch them up as well. Now, after a while, you tend to get a thick thatch layer, and what happens, it'll start to space the grass out. But to overcome that, we would simply use a plugging machine in the springtime, and we would plug these yards, which simply takes about an inch and a half's worth of dirt, brings the bottom dirt up, throws it on top, almost the top dressing at the same time.
Well, that's all the time we have for it, but it's a great tip. Thanks, Brian. Just coming to the bottom of the hour, we'll get another round of questions and comments about dirt, the erosion of civilizations, next for David Montgomery on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. That's the band Big Dirt, the group by David Montgomery, who's also our guest tonight. The next half hour, your questions about dirt, the erosion of civilizations, and the future of ours, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. One last round of calls for David Montgomery. Oh, by the way, David, what instrument do you play in the band Big Dirt?
No, I'm the guitar player in Big Dirt. There's okay. Four of us, and I'm the guitarist in this one.
Okay, you're not playing that fancy fiddle sound right there in the back.
No, that's a guy named Michael Spaley, who's an amazing fiddle player. He's brilliant. I wish I could play fiddle, let alone half that good.
And do you play? Do you have like a big festival? Do you have Dirt Stock every year or something
dirt
like that?
Stock. We should have Dirt Stock, shouldn't we? We play all over the Northwest, and if people like the music, you could check us out at BigDirtMusic.com or Big Dirt Music on MySpace. But our next show is in Seattle on March 7th at the Mars Bar. I'm actually in Europe now, and I have to fly back for that. But we play around a fair bit in the Northwest.
Are you you're in Europe as we speak?
I am in Europe as we speak in a completely different time zone. Yeah.
What are you doing? Touring on the book?
I'm actually finishing another book, and I'm on sabbatical, and the Swiss were kind enough to invite me to work at their Avalanche Research Institute for the winter. And since my wife skis, I couldn't say no.
So the Swiss gave you refuge. Because of some neutrality treaty or something, you were allowed to go there.
Well, the strange thing about writing books is that they're really hard to do in your own office.
Right.
And so basically I needed to get away. And I'm in the last couple weeks of finishing up my next book. So hopefully that'll be out in a year or two.
Okay, I'm going with you because you seem like a nice guy, but I just think that sounds just a little suspect. I have to go to Switzerland to write my books because otherwise I'm not inspired. My wife's got to be skiing and I've got to be in Switzerland or it just doesn't flow.
Well, you know, actually the last two books I wrote in Seattle. So
yeah.
I can't say I got to go to Switzerland, but when the invitation comes, I ain't going to turn it down.
Well, the important thing was your department head bought it. And let's go to Gene, who's in Ohio on Coast to Coast AM. Gene?
Yes. Good morning, Ian and David.
Good morning, Gene.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question and a comment. By the way, Ian, I grew up on a farm west of Minneapolis.
Oh, did you really? Whereabouts?
Hector, Minnesota. About 5 miles west on 212.
I it had got hit by a tornado, or it had something. It was there was a reason why it was in the news last year. I think.
Yes, you're right. Yes,
or a big fire or something. I can't remember what.
No, a tornado.
Was it a tornado? Great.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask David, have you done any studies on the Amish farms to see how their soil compares since they use the
old that's a great question.
Methods.
That's a really good question.
Yeah, the short answer to that is I haven't done studies, but I found a study from, I believe it was the Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania that had done exactly that. And if I recall correctly, what they were finding is that they were finding less erosion and more fertile soils on the Amish farms.
I would think so. I remember on our farm, they rotated the crops from one field to the other, hauled the manure out on the let the grass grow after the harvest, and plowed it under with the manure and had good soil every year.
Mm-hmm.
But that went away with the horses.
Yeah, I bet it did. But thank you, Gene. That's very interesting.
And may I make another comment? I read in an article they were talking about helping the small farmers around the world, and they said there's only one place left where there's genetic corn being grown, not genetic. And it's down in southern Mexico somewhere, and that is in danger because the people are so poor that they can't hardly afford to buy to keep the seed anymore.
That's very interesting, and I wish I knew more about that. That might be another show altogether in terms of the disappearing heritage crops that are out there where the ones that were indigenous to an area are disappearing, much like, in some cases, the indigenous languages or the indigenous people with them. John is in Boston, Massachusetts, on Coast AM for David Montgomery. Go ahead, John.
Okay. Hello, Ian. Hello, David. It's nice to be back on the show after many years. I haven't called in since Art Bell's time, actually.
Nice to have you.
I had two comments with always implied questions if you have any of your own comments to fire back at me. The first one was that Coast listeners are very familiar with something that is alleged to be a technology first invented by Thomas Townsend Brown called electrogravitics, which is basically a way to convert electric fields into gravity fields. And my point here is if Richard Hoagland is big on this and speaks of field propulsion and things like that, but if you can ever figure out how to do this, all of a sudden mass doesn't matter. Basically, bowling balls and feathers fall at the same time. We all know that. Fall at the same rate. We all know that. And that's true whether it's in the Earth's natural field or in an artificial one. So if you can ever figure out how to do this, you can just as well lift enormous weights of enormous masses of soil and transport them. And the neat thing is it doesn't cost you any energy, basically, not because you violated conservation of energy and you're at risk of a ticket, but because you borrowed the energy out of the zero-point field.
All right. Anyway. And your second point?
Second one is more down to earth, so to speak, and it's Adele Davis was a clinical nutritionist who wrote four very informative books on health and nutrition back in the 60s, and I think it was one called Let's Get Well. I might be wrong about which book, but I think that's the one. In the back, one of the later chapters, she talks about soil depletion. She makes the point that chemical fertilizers put in three chemicals, nitrogen, potassium, and phosphate, and the plant has a DNA program which pulls out whatever it needs, and it certainly doesn't limit itself to those three things. And over time, she says, commercial agriculture using these chemical fertilizers results in the other nutrients getting more and more scarce in the soil depletion. She says actually there were hearings on this in Congress in the 30s or something, and it's apparently known to be true, but we aren't really doing much about it. I wonder if you have especially comments on that one. I doubt you'll have much to say about electrogravitics, but
yeah, electrogravitics are kind of out of my realm of knowing much about. But the second point about the sort of depletion of trace minerals and other nutrients in soils from intensive cultivation relying primarily on fertilizers is a really, really, really good point. I ran into a few studies, a couple actually after I finished writing Dirt, that dealt with that issue, I think that there have been a few recent studies that have tried to look at the nutrient and trace element content of produce grown from in different manners in the different kinds of soils, and they see exactly the kind of effect that you're talking about. I'm not that familiar familiar enough with those studies or the public health implications to know how big an issue it is, but it certainly is one that I think deserves a lot of scrutiny and is probably a really good question to be asking in terms of whether or not we should, over the long run, continue to rely on sort of chemically intensive agriculture driving primarily from those three key inputs, if we're going to end up depleting other soil elements in ways that make food less nutritious. I think it's a really, really good point.
Alan's in Denver, Colorado on Coast to Coast AM. Alan?
Hi.
Hi, Alan.
Yeah, I've been a longtime listener, 12 years, first time I ever got through. There was a guy on Coast a while back, and his name was Joel Barker.
Yeah, I just had him on a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, and Innovations at the Verge is his book, I think.
Yep.
And he was
it's a video, actually, yep.
Okay, and he was talking about all different kinds of things, and one of the things he was talking about was that Terra Petra. I think that's how he said it.
Right, yeah. Terra Preta, right.
Preta.
Yeah.
And he was talking that they can manufacture it. They're working on being able to manufacture it, and
there's a company in Florida, and they already have all the funding they need. And remember, he was talking about how this is going to be the next big thing. Yep.
Yeah. And he was saying that it had something to do with they could use sewage to, like, put it on the soil, and then they would heat it or, like, flash fire it, and that's what did it. That was what made the process happen.
Well, in creating Terra Preta here, that's how they were doing it, was using a lot of sludge. And thank you, Alan. Yeah, it did just come up a couple of weeks ago on the air. And that's what he said, that they're going to kill the bad microbes out of it by using that kind of a process.
Yeah, and it is really an emerging technology that seems like a really good idea to explore, in the sense you can take organic matter that's urban waste, whether it's sewage or, you know, your leftover banana peel and your apple core and all the stuff that might, you know, you could compost, or you could send it into a large-scale urban composting system. And if you take that kind of organic matter-rich stuff and you combust it in a low-oxygen environment, you get charcoal.
Right.
But it also gives off natural gas. So you can essentially take what is urban waste and turn it into something where you get a bit of fuel back out of it, but you also get something that can really be a major soil enhancement out of it. And it, in turning it into charcoal, it becomes relatively inert, so it would break down slowly in the soil and could be a way to actually help sequester carbon back in soils and help with the global warming problem.
Yeah, I thought that was the interesting thing about it too, and that this company, I believe when Joel was just on, and I can ask him, I'm having lunch with him on Monday, I think what he was saying is that in the that they're going to be coming out with this in the next really next like 3 to 5 years. I mean, it's right around the corner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is kind of the cool thing that, and it may be, it could be in and of itself just a real great kick in the pants this economy needs. Blake is in Florida on Coast to Coast AM for David Montgomery. Go ahead, Blake.
I just had a few comments, actually. I'm a grad student here in Florida in Gainesville, and we actually are recycling free manure that we get here. We've got a small farm set up just outside of Gainesville here. And I've heard some comments about aquaculture and things like that. And we're actually feeding our fish off of a lot of even black waste and stuff. If you know much about a thing called black soldier flies, actually, the larva, we're feeding large amounts of organic material. And you can actually, after they've gone through that, feed it to worms and be very productive. And we're actually we have a large farm set up with a lot of diversity, and basically we're based on permaculture and setting up an ecosystem within a small plot of land and creating a lot of productivity and large yields. One of my real concerns is, do you think that some of these small organic farmers here in America can take over the whole petrol, chemical-based agriculture systems in place right now? Because I've heard some callers talk about crop depletion, and one of the big problems that I see is the huge monocultural crops that,
okay,
you know, they are depleting our soils basically by just using things that are killing a lot of the microbes.
Well, let's give David a chance to answer there. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, Blake, it's great to hear from you. The kind of stuff that you're involved with and working on are the kind of things that I was calling for in the book as the future of agriculture. And as a geologist, I kind of have the privilege of sort of looking long periods of time into the future, and so that I could see how our modern agriculture could be transformed over, you know, whether over the next 50 years, 100 or 200, to take advantage of the kind of things that you're involved with. How fast one could do it to sort of the large industrial agriculture of the American prairies, or in Russia or China for that matter, you know, that's going to be a real challenge, because a lot of agriculture that involves intensive nutrient recycling and relying on permaculture and agriculture and ecological systems to do a lot of the work and to sustain soil fertility, a lot of that can be much more labor intensive and involve and well done on small bits of land and large ones, the way farms have been set up now. And so, you know, I'm not sure whether to argue for sort of reversing the trend of farm size over the next 100 years, although I think that'd be a great idea. It would and help with these kinds of ideas, or how one pulls that off. But I think that the idea of permaculture is the way we need to be moving.
Well, you know, interesting possibility is that we may have to, just because we're going to have people who may be unemployed until we can get all of those aspects of the economy working again. Maybe that's what we do, is let's get something out of what may be a period of time where a lot of people end up being subsidized is why not put them, why not give them an opportunity to grow things and to try some of these experimental farms? It could be kind of the WPA of the future.
Yeah. You know, I think that's a great idea to think about, you know, depending on where the economy goes in the next decade. But the idea of if we're to use public jobs, we should be using those to reinvest in the future of society. And investing in soil restoration and recovery and the agricultural transformation that I think we need, the new agricultural revolution, is a great idea.
Anthony is in New Mexico on Coast to Coast for David Montgomery. Anthony?
Hey, David, this is Gabe. Anthony, I'm actually calling from the southern part of New Mexico. I actually grew up in the northern part of New Mexico, a little 20 miles south of Taos, New Mexico, up in the high desert of New Mexico. I don't know if you're familiar with that area.
Nice area, yeah.
Yeah, actually, I had a see if you could comment on genetically engineered food. You know, I've been reading up a little bit, you know, upon, you know, like boron, copper, molybdenum, that sort of thing. And I wonder if you could comment on, you know, like, you know, I've gone to, like, you know, the produce department of the store I work in, and it's just like, you know, you get, like, humongous oranges that are just out of this world, and apples and stuff. And I, you know, I remember when I was a kid, and, you know, you get these small apples that are real tasty and stuff. And, you know,
let's
it's just
give
like,
a chance to respond here. Hang on a second. Go ahead, David. How would you respond to that?
I'm not sure.
Big giant fruit and how things have been adjusted in that way, and
yeah,
all of the minerals that are
the square tomato problem and things like that. That you know, I think what I can probably best answer that by is describing how, as my wife and I have changed our behavior in terms of the kind of food that we buy and where we get it over the last couple years. As I got into doing the research for Dirt, and then now, as she and I have worked on the research for, you know, our forthcoming book, From the Ground Up, we've started going to farmers markets and sort of being much more selective about where we get our food, how we get it. And it's less uniform, but it's better. It tastes better. It's more nutritious. So we're voting with our feet.
Okay. That's the new book you said that you're working on right now, the one that couldn't be written without an alpine landscape in the background?
Actually, From the Ground Up is actually the next book out. Anne and I are set to start it. The one I'm finishing here is called Phantom Deluge, and it's a history of thinking about Noah's flood from geological and Christian, theological and scientific perspectives.
Oh, I'm so interested in that. That would be very interesting. I love that.
But it's a wonderful field in terms of how science and religion have cross-pollinated each other. You usually hear a lot about, you know, the conflict between the two. But the history of thinking about Noah's flood has as much cross-pollination as conflict. It's a wonderful story.
Terry's in California on Coast to Coast AM for David Montgomery in the time we have left, which isn't much. So, Terry, just ask you to keep it quick. Terry?
Trying to do the square foot gardening and doing it organically. And what would be the best worm type to help us with that?
Oh, what would be the best kind of worms for organic gardening?
Yeah.
Oh, man, you'd have to ask my wife.
But she's skiing right now, so she's unavailable. So, but I mean,
right, but she's the biologist in the family, and I hate to punt in that because it's a great question, but I need to because she's the expert.
Well, there's got to be a university extension office near you, Terry, and they might be able to tell you which one of the worms you should be using specifically in your area, too.
Yeah.
You don't want to bring in nasty foreign worms and mess things up. Thank you so much, David. I hope you had a good time talking about talking dirt for 3 hours.
No, Ian, I thoroughly enjoyed myself. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay. Have a wonderful time, and good luck on finishing that book and the next one as well. And we'll link up to David Montgomery, both for his work on dirt and also the band Big Dirt. You can find him at coasttocoastam.com. I'll be on tomorrow night, special night. Looking forward to it. Jason in the first hour to celebrate Friday the 13th coming up, and Deus Tamat, and I do too.